pleasure to welcome you to the 1993-94 Murrin Lectures, a lecture series that is now in its fifth year, and as in past years, is enabled by a generous grant from the Murrin Fund, which is a UBC fund concerned with supporting issues to do with spirituality on the UBC campus. The group organizing this function is the Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum, another UBC organization that meets monthly and is concerned to discuss issues around the intersection of faith and scholarship. And I suspect most of you will have received a copy of this year's program for this organization that's being handed out at the door. I'd also want to bring to your attention a book table at the front, which has got some of Dr. Tinder's work on it, and also some related books around the issues of politics, philosophy, and Christian faith. Tapes are being made of both lectures, today's and tomorrow's lecture, and if any of you would be interested in purchasing tapes, please sign your names at the front with a phone number at the book table afterwards. Now, it is my very great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Glenn Tinder. Glenn Tinder was born a Californian. He conducted his doctoral studies in political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He moved to Harvard for postdoctoral study, and I suspect little understood at the time that that was the beginning of a 40-year sojourn in the state of Massachusetts, where he has, for almost all of that time, been in the associated with the University of Massachusetts. His current position is Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Glenn Tinder's work has been in the sphere of political philosophy. His earlier books, The Crisis of Political Imagination, a text, Political Thinking, that's now gone through five editions, were in a sense preparations for a more normative turn that his writing has taken since the mid-1970s. So that 1976, he published a book called Tolerance Toward a New Civility, followed by Community, Reflections on a Tragic Ideal. In 1981, Against Fate, an Essay on Personal Dignity. And in some ways, all of this normative turn was brought to a head in his celebrated 1989 book, The Political Meaning of Christianity. In that book, he discusses the issue of hope. And it is on that theme that he is going to present the Murrin Lectures this year. Help reflecting on how powerful was his intuition on identifying the issue of hope. When I read Maclean's magazine last week and saw its lead story discussing the current election campaign was searching for signs of hope. And in the second paragraph, the journalist writes, such profound despair has shaken federal politicians that it has turned hope into the central theme of the October 25th federal election. I don't think that's a matter of historical happenstance, but rather a sign of the depth of his insight that he should come up here and find that he is speaking to an issue which is at the very center, perhaps as a subtext, of our own election campaign. Today, Professor Tinder is speaking to the subject Personal Hope, the Citizen in an Age of Despondency. And tomorrow, in this room at 4:30, Political Hope, the State in an Age of revolution.
Professor Glenn Kinder.
Thank you, David. Let me say at the beginning that I'm going to talk rather than read a prepared address, and that implies no disrespect for this series of lectures which I've been invited to give. I'm very grateful for being invited to give the lectures. It's always tempting to read something that is prepared in advance, because then you're secured against the possibility of misstating something on the spur of the moment. You're secured against the possibility of losing the thread of the argument midway through. It's much more relaxing to have pages here which I can turn and look up occasionally and try to read with feeling. But nothing takes the place of talking, and of actually being present through talking. And I've many times prepared lectures and read them, but I always feel that I'm cut off from the people in the audience. I feel that all I'm doing really is reading an article which they just as well read for themselves, and that they could read it faster than I can, since I'm reading aloud. So I'm going to speak, just to speak. I'm going to run the risk simply of speaking. I particularly value speaking rather than reading, because I'm not so much trying to convey a systematic set of ideas which I think you should accept, as I am trying to set forth a few ideas which are interrelated, somewhat organized, but a few ideas which I would hope some of you would find worth thinking about. These are ideas which it has taken me a long time to reach, and I'm not conscious of anyone else holding some of these ideas, at least just as they are. So some of you might be able to think about them and carry them further or understand them better than I can. But my intent, in short, is dialogical rather than hortatory or didactic. My intent is to engage in discourse and in what I hope will be a common process of thought with all of you. Another preliminary comment that perhaps I should make is this, and that is that I speak as a Christian, but I am concerned with what's called Christian wisdom. And I understand Christian wisdom to be a wisdom which is present in Christianity, but is not possessed by Christians alone, and is not accessible to Christians alone. Christianity, I think, contains insights into human history and into human nature which are of importance to everyone. They are of importance to the whole world. And these are insights which can be understood and accepted by people in the world at large. In reference to hope, I'm thinking about Christianity and about hope in connection with Christianity. But Christianity gives us insights into hope which might very well be accepted widely in the world and understood widely. In other words, Christianity can help the world, help non-Christians as well as Christians, to understand many things in our common life and our common experience. I'm saying all of this particularly because I imagine that some of you here are not Christians. And I want to assure you that even though I speak as a Christian and sometimes appeal to Christian ideas, try to illuminate Christianity, nevertheless, that I'm speaking to you. I'm speaking to people who aren't Christians as well as to people who are Christians. I might finally just indicate at the outset how this lecture relates to the following lecture so that you'll know what I'm doing today. Today I'm going to talk principally about personal hope. I'm going to talk about hope as we personally experience it and search for it. In doing this, I'm going to be concerned particularly with the nature of hope, trying to discover what hope is. In the lecture tomorrow, I'm going to turn to the political world. And I think that what I see about the nature of hope in the personal world applies to the political world. And I'm going to try to show this in the political world. But there won't be many political references today, even though I'm a political scientist, because I want to look first at hope in its most intimate form. I want to look at hope as it is in our lives. Now, it might seem that it's not really necessary to talk all of this much about hope. It might seem as though it's not necessary to think about hope, because hope is something that seems familiar to us. We all hope all of the time. All of us have hoped for some things today. When I was sitting in a restaurant at noon and looked out and saw that it was raining, I hoped it would quit raining before I started home. And it did. And we all are hoping all of the time for various things of this sort. So hope is something that is very familiar to us. And in that sense, it may seem to be something which we don't really need to think about. Well, there are several reasons why I think hope is something we need very much to think about today. And indeed, I don't think there is anything else that we need as much to think about today, or any more to think about today, than the matter of hope. For one thing, we live, I believe, in a time of relatively little hope. The title of this lecture is The Citizen in an Age of Despondency. And I think that we live in an age which it is not too much to call a despondent age. This may not seem to you to be true. I think it doesn't seem to most people to be true. But I suspect that there is an undercurrent of despair might be too strong a word for it, but an undercurrent of hopelessness that affects all of us and that we can't escape, and that lends a somber tone to our lives, even though we may not be aware of just why it is that our lives have that somber tone. One reason for thinking of this is that we live in a very terrible century. Hannah Arendt referred to it as this terrible century. Elizabeth Bishop spoke of it as the worst century so far. We live in a century which has seen phenomena of the kind you're all familiar with, that you've all read about. The 4 years of futile trench warfare in World War I, the rise of totalitarianism in Russia and in Germany and in Italy, the death camps in Germany, the Gulag Archipelago in the Soviet Union, World War II, and all of you are familiar with things that are going on in our own time, like the enormities in Bosnia and the atrocities that took place in Cambodia not very long ago. We live in a century which challenges hope, which almost inevitably undermines hope. Henry James, the novelist, said when in the midst of the trench warfare of World War I, he said that to think that all of the centuries up until this time have been leading to this is just unbearable. And in that way, he expressed his sense of how his whole perception of the meaning of Western history had been undermined by what he was seeing happen. I think none of us can escape this. I don't think it makes a lot of difference whether you have read very much about trench warfare or about the death camps or about totalitarianism. Nobody in our time lives without being conscious that these things have happened. And if those things can happen, then what else may not happen in our time? Sartre says in his novel Nausea, at some point he says, anything can happen. Anything. If you feel that way, if you feel that anything can happen, anything, then you're hopeless. And I think it's hard not to feel that way. Nobody expected trench warfare and totalitarianism and these other things in the 19th century. No one foresaw these things coming. These came as an immense and ghastly surprise to the world. The fact that they have come, however, can't leave us unaffected. We're bound to have the sense that anything can happen. Anything. And having that feeling, we are bound to be, if only unconsciously, frightened. Well, that's one reason we have to think about hope. A second reason is that hope is vital to us. Hope is not just something like, a good complexion or strong legs or something that it's nice to have but that you can live without if you don't happen to have it. Hope is something that you can't really live without if you don't have a little bit of it. Anyway, because hope is what carries you forward into the future. Hope is the breath of life. And if you're hopeless, you're paralyzed. To be hopeless is to recoil before the future. And in that way, to be frozen into the present. And if you're truly frozen into the present, of course, then you die. Because to live is to live into the future. Politically, just for a word on this side of things, hope is no less vital than it is to an individual. I don't think a healthy politics is possible where there's no hope. Healthy politics means being able to live with patience, to bear arguments that you think are very wrong and that may possibly lose, may possibly win. To engage in a healthy politics is to be able to reason together with your fellow citizens. It takes an immense amount of patience, and it takes a sense that that things are going in the right direction. In short, it takes hope. Where there is hopelessness, individuals are almost certainly going either to turn to private life, feeling that there is nothing in public life that is good, that can happen. They're almost certain to turn into their private life in a kind of desperate effort to find life in their private existence. Or else they're apt to commit themselves to some kind of fanatical cause in a desperate effort to escape from hopelessness. This is what I think happened in 1933 in Germany when the Germans elected Hitler and accepted his rule. The kind of politics all of us believe in, consequently, can't occur without hope. So we need hope very badly. One final reason why hope needs thinking about is that it's a very puzzling thing. Far from being obvious, it's difficult. I hadn't realized this until I began working on hope. I thought that my last book, The Political Meaning of Christianity, was a book about hope. And I kind of wanted to say some of the things I'd said in that book, but to recast them somewhat. And I thought that hope was a rather important topic, so I decided to write a book on hope. And I thought this would be easy, and I expected to have it done within a year or two. And what I have discovered since starting all of that is that it's an immensely difficult topic. And I have worked on it again and again and written drafts and new drafts of the book I'm working on and had a very difficult time working out and discovering the nature of and then being able to lay out and organize coherent thoughts on the nature of hope. The reason hope is such a difficult topic, I realize now, is that to live with hope is to live in time. And there is nothing that is more puzzling than time. If any of you have read St. Augustine's Confessions, you're familiar with the puzzles of time. For example, how can the past be real? Presumably the past can't be real since the past is past. It's gone. It must not be real. And yet all of us know that it's very real indeed. What kind of reality can the past possibly have? Or the present? You may say the present is real. But try to live in the present moment. And as soon as you get focused on the present moment, it's gone. So you can't live within the present moment. But what about the future? Can you live for the future? The future doesn't exist. It wouldn't be future if it existed now. And yet we all know that certain things are going to be. And we know that we're going to be, that something is going to happen to us in the future. Whether we want it to or not, we can't help it. It's as though we're being carried forward by a stream. We're being carried forward into the future. These are very puzzling things. But hope is living in time. And since time is so puzzling, hope is puzzling. Now be prepared, consequently, for me to say some things which are puzzling. It's possible that when I say these puzzling things, they will be puzzling because I have not said them very well and don't understand them perfectly. But it is possible also that they will be puzzling because they are intrinsically hard to understand. At any rate, I think I'm going to say some things that go contrary to fairly widely prevailing ideas about hope. I have to build up to these things. And I'm going to start with a matter which is pretty simple and maybe a little bit puzzling, but I think fairly easy to understand. And this is that if we ask what it is we truly hope for, profoundly, ultimately, we discover that we don't hope for the things that we hope for day by day. I hoped that it wouldn't be raining when I left the restaurant, but I've practically forgotten all about that now. That was not a big thing in my life, and in a day or so I will have forgotten it completely. And these hopes come and go, the things that we hope for, and even the big things we hope for, the hope for a job, the hope for a promotion, the hope to be able to obtain a particular house, to be able to take a particular trip, to be able to enter a particular profession, even these big things that we hope for, they really don't satisfy us. We human beings, here I'm talking mainly about human nature, not about what is uniquely a Christian insight. We human beings have what sometimes seems like an accursed capacity to ask, what then? What comes next? Now, we may ask this in the midst of something that we've hoped for, and we begin to feel that it's not very satisfying after all, and realize that we still have a life to lead and that we have to look further ahead and think further about the future. We may ask then? What's coming next? We may even ask this in advance. And some people are cursed with the tendency to ask, what can I possibly gain that is going to be satisfying? The human capacity I'm referring to basically might be called something like transcendence. We have the ability to stand beyond every finite, limited good, and to realize that it's coming to an end, and that it doesn't quite suffice, that something more is needed. As due to this capacity, a deep sense of futility can arise within people. Through this sense of futility, and through asking what then, and through questioning our finite goals, we realize that none of the things we hope for is the end. If we keep on looking ahead, if we employ this capacity for transcendence and keep on looking ahead, what we realize, as Keynes put it, is that in the long run we'll all be dead. And this is the sense of futility made explicit. Now this means that hopes that are going to be quenched in death, hopes for things that are going to pass away, hopes for things that are going to leave us more or less dissatisfied, hopes for things that are going to ask us, what then? These don't fill the mind. These are not the kind of hope that Paul was speaking of when he classed hope along with faith and charity as the three fundamental virtues of a human being. What we realize as we think along these lines is that hope is for something finite, something infinite and eternal. We realize that hope is for something lasting, for something limited. And I'm not saying here that there is any such thing. That's not the precise point I'm making now. But we realize, if we really think about hope, that that's what we want. We human beings are creatures who are oriented by our very nature. This is not primarily a Christian claim. We are oriented by our very nature towards the infinite and eternal, towards the good that is limitless, towards the good that does not end. This is what we inevitably hope for and seek and want to realize in our lives. I don't claim at all that everyone is conscious of this. I think there are many people, particularly in our time, who don't think about this sort of thing very much and live pretty much from day to day. And all of us have that capacity, too, along with the capacity to ask what's in. We're able to live from day to day and not think very much about the infinite and eternal. But the infinite and eternal alone, a limitless good, everlasting good, this is the only thing that can really satisfy us. And if there is not such a good as this, then life has got to have a tragic coloring to it. There's no way to escape that. The great German philosopher Nietzsche saw this very clearly and realized that life without this kind of Christian hope, and he believed life had to be without that kind of hope, that it had to take on, the best it could take on was a sort of tragic grandeur. Now, this infinite and eternal thing that we hope for, this has been given a lot of names. Philosophers throughout the ages have held that there indeed is a possibility of such a good, that a limitless and everlasting good does indeed exist. And they've given us various kinds of names. Plato referred to it simply as the form of the good, or as the good, and he likened it to the sun. And there are resplendent pages in the Republic in which he speaks of the good. For Aristotle, it was the unmoved mover. It was the object of contemplation for human beings, and the highest form of human life lay in the contemplation of this ultimate being in which all started, the unmoved mover. In modern philosophy, this everlasting good has been given other names, with Hegel and the idealist, it was called the absolute. The thought of Heidegger and Marcel and others is referred to as being in itself. The thought of Carl Jaspers and other thinkers, it is called transcendence, the idea of something that is beyond, transcendent. But in all of these visions, there is the notion of something that is beyond the finite things that we hope for. None of these people I've referred to are Christians. Well, Hegel was, but aside from Hegel, these people were not Christians. So they're not conveying a Christian message. They're conveying the idea that there is something. There is something which, in a sense, is not anything, is not a thing. It's beyond all things because it's infinite, eternal. But beneath everything or above everything, depending on what spatial metaphor you want to use, there is a reality which does indeed satisfy human hope. In Christian terms, this, of course, is God. In Christian terms, what we hope for is God. There is just one difference in the Christian view, in the Christian concept of hope, that I might point out. There are a number of differences, but there is one that is important for us to take into account here. And that is that for the philosophers, the good, transcendence, is more or less inert. It awaits human ascent. It allows human beings to ascend to it, but it's like a mountain peak, as it were. It's there, and we can reach it if we try to. For Christians, God or the good, the transcendent, is in search of human beings. That in a way reverses things. According to the Christian view, human beings have turned away from God, and God is in search of human beings. And this gives hope a different character in Christianity. Hope comes to be a matter of being ready to be found, a readiness for God. I think I won't say any more about that, because the things that we have to talk about are too numerous to be for us really to have time to speak of that. But it's worth noting that. But in both cases, whether in the case of Christians or in the case of Plato and Aristotle and Hegel and the great philosophers, in all of these together, there is truly something to hope for, the infinite and the eternal. And this doesn't rule out worldly hopes. It doesn't mean that it's wrong to hope for things within this world. But the things that we hope for within this world are things we shouldn't hope for unless somehow they are connected with the infinite and the eternal. Unless these are things which reflect transcendence or being in itself, that somehow guide us or buoy us up or carry us on in the direction of eternity. I'll speak more about those legitimate worldly hopes a little bit later. Now, to move ahead, I have to take into account a rather puzzling thing about transcendence. It's necessary to take this into account in order to for us to talk about hope with understanding. This puzzling thing is that somehow, paradoxically, the infinite is present in the finite. Eternity is present in time. The transcendent is present in the things that are immanent, the things that are around us. This sounds very strange, and it's no doubt strange, but the recognition of this is very widespread. It's very clear, for example, in Plato. The good for Plato is not something which is simply way up in the intellectual stratosphere, which human beings can possibly reach. The good is somehow present within things around us, and an object of beauty, the good may be present. For Hegel, the absolute was not just a nearly inconceivable totality of things, which he spoke of as being. It also was present in the little things of our lives, and in the small developments of our lives. The absolute was here, within us. Now, this is very important for understanding our relationship with transcendence. The fact that transcendence can be present, the fact that the infinite can be here in finite things. How? In what way? This is bound to affect the way in which we live the life of hope. I want to give you two examples of how transcendence can be immanent, of how the infinite can be in the finite. Two examples which are particularly important for us in thinking about hope. The first of these examples is the human being. As a great many different people have recognized, in one way or another, an individual human being, a human being who is here and now, like me standing at this lectern, like you, sitting in your seats, an individual human being is somehow reflective of the eternal or of the infinite. This is brought out right at the beginning of Genesis, right at the beginning of the Bible, in the book of Genesis, which says that God created man in his own image and likeness. A human being is the image of God. Theologians are very reluctant to try to say just exactly what that means. But it says clearly that what is that the good, God, what is beyond, is somehow present here in a human being. Now, I don't want it to seem as though I'm posing a philosophical conundrum, which it's almost impossible to understand, because we all experience the presence of the eternal in a human being occasionally. We experience it when we love somebody. To love somebody is to feel that this person whom you love is something more than just this mortal, limited, defective creature that is before you. You don't look at anyone you love in that way. Martin Buber, the Jewish philosopher, speaks of the vow, the person you love, as filling the sky. And that's a very nice metaphor for bringing out the sense of infinitude that there is about someone whom you love. That person fills the sky, is in some sense infinite. We express this idea, of course, when we speak of the sacredness of a human being. We express this idea when we condemn human beings who devote their lives to physical pleasures because we feel they diminish themselves. They turn themselves into limited creatures. From being something infinite, they turn into something finite. From being everlasting in some sense, they turn themselves into something that is purely mortal. Now, the result of this, the fact that the infinite is present in the finite person, for one thing, we extend this to everyone when we speak of the sacredness of a human being. So to speak, we extend love and the power of love to everyone. And we say, in effect, if I could understand every human being in the world deeply and fully, then each person in the world would fill the sky, because I would love each person within the world. Now, the result of all of this is that hope is always not just for the infinite, not just for that which is beyond. It is always for human beings together with the beyond. Jesus doesn't announce just the coming of God. He announces the coming of the kingdom of God. Most Christians realize that they wouldn't want to end up in heaven as the only human being there, just that one person in God. They envision a kingdom of human beings with God. Karl Barth, the great theologian, was particularly fond of the music of Mozart, so much so that he listened to Mozart every day, and he saw Mozart as a kind of wonder who brought the ultimate truths into the form of sound. And Barth said that the first thing that he would do when he got to heaven was to ask to see Mozart. And this expresses this sense that we don't hope just to see God or just to see the infinite or just to see the eternal. We want to see our friends also. That's one way in which the infinite is present in the finite. There's a second way, and is that the infinite gives a mysterious sense of meaning to all worldly events. The infinite makes sense, some kind of strange, inexplicable sense, out of the things that happen, and even out of the very worst things that happen. Anyone who lives with an acute consciousness of transcendence lives with a sense that things somehow have meaning, that life is not purely senseless. This is a hard idea to understand, because all of us have the feeling that there are a lot of things that happen that are purely senseless. All of us have the feeling that a lot of things have occurred which in all eternity can't be justified. Trench warfare seems like that. a terrible automobile accident. Seems like something of this sort. Totalitarianism, the Holocaust, seems like something of this kind. And so we're inclined to say, this can't be. It's impossible that everything should make sense. But think about tragic drama, for one thing. Think about the feeling that you have after watching one of Shakespeare's great tragedies, or after reading a tragedy of Sophocles or of Aeschylus. You have the feeling somehow that these terrible events which you've been concerned with are justified. Somehow they're acceptable, and you can't explain it. Anything you try to say to explain it will sound awkward and unsatisfactory. But that is the kind of feeling we have after watching tragic drama. A great tragic poet is able to recast terrible events, as T.S. Eliot does the murder of Thomas Becket. They're able to recast these terrible events so that somehow in reading them, in recounting and remembering those events, you feel they make sense. They are justified. The supreme example of this for Christians is the crucifixion. I was giving a talk one time and said something on this order, and a very intelligent-looking woman in the audience objected on the grounds that there are some things couldn't possibly make any sense, and she gave as an example a young man being tortured to death. That was her example of something that couldn't possibly make sense. But of course, that precisely describes what happened to Jesus. The cross was an instrument of torture, as you all know. Jesus was a young man in his early 30s, and he was tortured to death. But to say that the cross has meaning for Christians would be an understatement. They have seen it as the key to the meaning of the whole universe. They have seen it as a disclosure of the meaning of all history. Every Christian, consequently, who is centered on the crucifixion, takes the crucifixion with the same seriousness as Paul did, or the Synoptic Gospels do. Every such Christian believes that even so terrible an event as the torture to death of a young man somehow is meaningful. And this is what transcendence always tends to do. It always tends to give meaning to worldly events. Let me give you one final example for those of you who are still skeptical that terrible worldly things can be meaningful. And this is one from secular culture. Most novelists, and preeminently the great novelists such as Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, these are people who are engaged in making sense out of terrible things. Most of these novelists recount awful occurrences. Dostoevsky, for example, talks about unspeakable things, crimes and torture and rape, things that if they happen to you or someone you know, you feel sickened. You feel sickened even by reading about them. And yet, after you've finished a novel by Dostoevsky, you don't feel sickened. He's like a tragic dramatist. He has somehow pieced these things together so that they make sense, as terrible as they are. Any novelist does this. The best novelists, I think, all do it. I shouldn't say quite that any novelist does it. There are a few novelists like Henry Miller or Céline, or a few who simply exhibit absurdity. But there are dozens of great novelists who make sense out of things. Now, with this, let's turn to the nature of hope, because I think I've laid a foundation now for understanding what it means to live with hope. And here I'm going to suggest some ideas which are certainly counter to what I thought before I began thinking about this topic, and I believe these are counter to what most people assume. about hope. But the more I think about them, the more I think they're true, or at least that they're worth your thinking about. Now, to begin with, if I am right, hope doesn't involve trying to envision the future, trying to imagine the future, trying to live somehow within the future. And the reason for this simply is that we can't comprehend the future. If the future has something to do with God, the infinite, the eternal, we comprehend it. The Bible says, and Paul quotes this, "Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for those who love Him." We can't understand the future. If the future we hope for is somehow, in some sense, an experience of eternity, of the infinite, if it's an experience of life in the presence of God, which is what Christians hope for, if that is in the nature of the future, we can't comprehend it. We don't know what it would be like. And if it is true that eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for him, for those who love Him, then we shouldn't try to. We shouldn't try to think about it. There are parts in the Bible that emphasize this notion that we shouldn't attempt to grasp the future. The book of Isaiah, for example, and one of my favorite verses, says, "Who among you fears the Lord and obeys the voice of His servant, who walks in darkness and has no light?" Walks in darkness and has no light. Doesn't try to comprehend the future, yet trusts in the name of the Lord and relies upon His God. "Behold, all you who kindle a fire and set brands alight." Behold, all you who kindle a fire and set brands alight. That is, all you who try to shine a light into the future and to imagine what the future is going to be. According to Isaiah, God says, "Walk by the light of your fire and by the brands you have kindled. This shall you have from my hand, you shall light and torment." So the Bible seems to say very clearly that we try to live into the future in the sense of trying to imagine what it means. All we can do with the future is to entrust ourselves to it. In a sense, to rely upon the future to lead us. But that has to be one step at a time, and not in accordance with a fire we have kindled, or in accordance with brands which we have lighted. There's good secular evidence of the wisdom of what I'm saying, I think. Think of utopias, for example. It's possible some of you like utopias, but I think fundamentally utopias are boring in their utopian aspects. A great utopia like Plato's Republic is not boring, but that's because in general he wasn't trying to say what the future is going to be like. He was setting forth a philosophy, a stirring philosophy. But people who, utopias that really try to say what the future can or should be like, I think are extremely tedious. They seem very human and very willful and arbitrary, and you don't feel that you're having a future unfolded before you, but rather that you're being shown something which is just human and finite and not very interesting. Utopias, furthermore, of course, are misleading. Lenin, who was one of the most damaging people who has ever lived in history, lived on the basis of a kind of utopian vision, that which he set forth in State and Revolution. Utopias can do damage of that kind. Or to turn to Christians, they've given their own examples of how vapid our images of the hope of the future are. Think of the pictures that you see of the kingdom of heaven. I remember a fresco on the walls of a medieval cathedral in Florence, what some medieval fresco artist took to be a picture of the kingdom of heaven. And this was everyone standing in great vast ranks among the clouds singing hymns. And I go to church and I sing my hymns dutifully, but singing hymns is not really my favorite occupation. And if I thought the kingdom of heaven meant that for all eternity I would be standing along with millions and millions of fellow human beings singing hymns, I would be sorely disappointed in how God had arranged things. And this seems to me again to show how impossible it is for us to imagine the future. I think the first thing we have to do if we want to live with hope is to resign from the future, to entrust ourselves to it, but not to try to see ahead into it. What then should we do? The answer, I think, is to live within the present, to live in your present situation. Let your present situation carry you into the future, but don't try to see what that future is. Here, in your present situation, you encounter human beings who, if you can really love them and understand them, reflect the infinite. Here, in your present situation, in doing and suffering the things which you have to do and have to suffer, you experience and live the meaning which transcendence or God gives to human life. We can understand the present. While we can't understand the future, we can understand our situation. Often it's unpleasant. In fact, I suspect usually our situations, personal situations, are more or less unpleasant, and we would like to escape from them. But to live with hope is to assume that you will be carried through your present situation by God, by transcendence, into the future. And that the future is something with which you don't need to bother yourself. What you need to do is to employ your conscience in order to know what you have to do now. And when there is nothing you can do, then you simply have to suffer what you are forced to suffer now. And in doing this, you live the meaning which God or transcendence writes into human existence. There's a great Christian who has expressed this in words which are familiar to most of you, but I think it's worth reading these because they bring out very explicitly what I'm trying to say. This Christian is Cardinal Newman, and these words are expressed in a famous hymn, so these will be familiar, at least the start of them. He wrote, "Lead kindly light amid the encircling gloom, lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home. Lead thou me on. Keep thou my feet. I do not ask to see." Listen to this. This is particularly what I'm attempting in my own awkward way to say. "Keep thou my feet. I do not ask to see the distant scene. I do not ask to see the distant scene. One step enough for me." I can't help having it occur to me just at the moment that this one may seem irreverent, but one of the most successful organizations in the United States, I don't know about Canada, but in the United States, is Alcoholics Anonymous. And they have tremendous success in renewing human lives. And their motto is one step at a time. And in a sense, what I'm saying, what Newman was saying, is one step at a time. And that's what I'm saying, that what I'm suggesting that living with hope means, taking one step at a time. There's one final thing that has to be said about hope. And this will seem, in a way, I think, the most anomalous of the things that I've said about what it means to live with hope. I've said that to live with hope, you should not try to look ahead and trust yourself to the future, but don't try to comprehend what the future is going to bring. You don't even try to imagine it. So you shouldn't look into the future. But I believe that to live with hope means that you should look into the past. We don't have the power of foresight. God has not given us the power to see ahead very far. And if we try to see ahead, then according to Isaiah, this is a form of human pride which will be cursed by God. But we do have the power of memory. We do have the power of looking back and remembering. God has given us that power. the power of looking back over our own lives and looking back over history and remembering and piecing things together, trying to understand what has happened in the past. There is a kind of glib optimism that says, forget the past. What is past, and let it go. That, it seems to me, is deeply wrong. Freud, for one, made it clear that you can't forget the past. If you try to forget the past is going to tag along, and it's going to be a very bothersome companion if you don't know what it is. The past is going to be there, and the only way to make it an agreeable companion is to remember it and to tame it, so to speak. Another writer in our time has spoken of the past in a way which I think is very suggestive. And this writer is Milan Kundera, the great Czech novelist. And Kundera says, people are always shouting that they want to create a better future. He says it's not true. The future is an apathetic void of no interest to anyone. I'm not sure that is right. He's putting it a little strongly. But nevertheless, that's what he says. But then he goes ahead about the past. The past is full of life, eager to irritate us, provoke and insult us, tempt us to destroy or repaint it. The past is full of life, eager to irritate us, to provoke us. That, it seems to me, is the truth. And consequently, we have to pay attention to the past. And to live with hope, consequently, means looking back and trying to understand what is behind us. Why, however? Why should we look back? The answer, I think, is simply that the only way we can discover meaning and begin to sense the meaning which transcendence or God gives to our lives is through remembering, through looking back and seeing how things that happened in the past do have meaning. And this, of course, means that we ought to give particular attention to disagreeable things, to the things that we don't want to remember, because those are the things that we ought particularly to try to plumb, to understand, and to see the meaning in. Well, this task of remembrance, I suggest to you, is a task of hope. It's a task of giving foundations to the present in which we have to live. It's a task of hope, and it seems to me it's one of the great human activities. Much of literature, novels, for example, poetry and drama, much of literature is remembering and looking back. And some of the most compelling things human beings do and write are the writing of memoirs and the writing of autobiographies, the writing of the great histories. These are among the great human activities, looking. One of the greatest works of Western literature is Proust's 7 volumes, Remembrance of Things Past. Looking back, to live the life of hope then, is to look back, to try to make sense out of the things in back of you. In this way, to try to build foundations for the present in which you do and suffer the things you have to do and suffer. And in this way, let yourself be carried into the future. Now, if any of these things which I have said make it sound as though hope is a grim thing, I haven't been accurate, because I don't intend for it to sound that way. It's true, I think, that living with hope can have a certain quality sometimes of having to endure, to put up with things. Living with hope can involve suffering sometimes, or doing things which you don't want to endure. But fundamentally, it's not grim. Fundamentally, it is living in accordance with the deep currents of life. This at any rate is true. If there is such a thing as transcendence, if there is such a being as God, and if God is present in the lives we lead, and if God and transcendence give meaning to the lives we lead, then to live with hope is to live in accordance with these deep currents of life. Dostoevsky expressed this with incomparable force in the advice which Porfiry the detective gave to Raskolnikov the murderer. And those of you who've read Crime and Punishment will recall that Porfiry the detective knew that Raskolnikov was the murderer long before Raskolnikov had confessed. But Porfiry was sympathetic with Raskolnikov, and he thought he had potentialities for being a good human being. And he thought it would be a lot better for Porfiry to give himself up voluntarily. And he tried to talk Raskolnikov, the murderer, into doing this. And this is a part of what he said to Raskolnikov. And here he's talking about hope. Raskolnikov was a man in despair, and the detective here is talking about hope. He says, plunge straight into life without deliberation. Plunge straight into life without deliberation. Don't be uneasy. It will carry you to the shore and set you on your feet. It will carry you to the shore and set you on your feet. What shore? He's asking, what shore? What will this future be? And Porfiry says, how should I know? What shore? How should I know? I know that you do not believe me, but it is a sacred truth. It is a sacred truth that life will sustain you. Life will sustain you. That's what I think it means to live with hope, to realize that and to live on the basis of that realization. I thank you.
I realize some of you need to leave at this point, but Professor Tinder did mention dialogue at the beginning, and he would be very eager, I know, to now receive some questions from you. So I would invite you to offer any questions to him.
Yes. There are a few novelists who do that. I wouldn't say predominantly they do, but... I, in a sense, I don't have anything to say except that I agree that there's no hope in that kind of an outlook. And where I feel this is particularly in the philosophy of Marx. And Marx is often thought of as being a philosopher of great hope because he presents a very grand vision of the progress of the human race towards a state of perfect harmony. And yet, there was very little hope, truly, in Marx, because Marx had no hope of any victory over death. There was no experience of any limitless and everlasting good in Marx. Now, all Marx hoped for was a state of things which people could enjoy for perhaps 70 or 80 years, then from which they would die, and a state of things which most of the human race would never experience, because they would have lived before the time in which this hope was realized. So I think it's a great mistake to sell Marx as just one example of what I take it you're speaking of. I think it's a great mistake to see him as a philosopher of great hope. In comparison with St. Paul, for example, Marx was a man in despair who was simply trying to make the best of it. Repeat the question? Oh, I'm... I'm sorry. I've given you the answer, and now I'll give you the question. The question was had to do with the questioner spoke of biology and presumably of the doctrine of evolution and of where this leads and how there seems to be no hope ultimately, no real hope in that kind of outlook. And asked me to comment, and I commented simply by using the example of Marx as a materialist who was basically, I think, a resigned and despairing man. Right. Mm-hmm. I think we're torn two ways on these things, I must admit. If you believe that there is a God and that the utmost hopes are possible, this makes life a very serious matter. It makes life in some way burdensome. It means that you have a lot to think about and that you have to take very seriously the question as to how you live. On the other hand, if there is no God, that burden is lifted. If there is no God, then in a sense you're set free. You can live any way you want to. Doesn't matter what you do ultimately, because everything will end in death. In short, as Dostoevsky said, all is permitted if there is no God. And while that's a terrible view in a way, that all is permitted, in a sense, it's particularly if you're young, and enjoy life, well, it's sort of relaxing. You don't have to be all that serious about life. C.S. Lewis commented on the kind of people who are always saying, I would love to believe in God. I want very much to believe in God, but I just can't. And C.S. Lewis expressed great skepticism about most of these people. He didn't think most of them really did want to believe in God, because God did give life a kind of seriousness which many people found burdensome. So I think that we're torn both ways. But to give up God for the sake of a kind of lighthearted life is basically to enter into despair. And I think that despair is bound to deepen as your life goes on. Well, other questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah. Looking forward, I press toward the mark.
Yeah.
For the prize of my calling of God in Christ Jesus.
Uh-huh.
Is there a reconciliation of those two statements?
You've got me, to put it very briefly. I'm, of course, very conscious of those words in Paul, and I assume that he didn't mean that we should just try to forget about the past. For one thing, Paul, as a Christian, of course, believed that we had a fundamental task of remembrance always before us, and that is of remembering Christ and trying to live in accordance with Christ. And I assume that when he was speaking of forgetting those things which are past, that he meant somehow that he was speaking in a rhetorical way about changing the course of his life and giving it a new direction. Because Paul was far too profound, I think, to suppose that we ought simply to take no account of the past. And you can see this in the fact that in his letters, which after all are pretty short, he still gives rather full accounts of the things that he did in the past and tells about his persecution of the Jews and his conversion and his voyages and various other things in the past. So I assume he can't have meant it literally what he said. But I would like to know what he did mean, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he didn't mean to forget the law either. He said, he and Jesus both said that the law had to be fulfilled. We had to live beyond the law, but we didn't live against the law and regardless of the law. And the law in its own way, Paul said quite explicitly, was good. He didn't again mean forgetting that. He meant living beyond it. And so I assume that that's what he really meant when he said forgetting those things that are past. That at least part of what he meant was getting beyond those things that are past. Yes?
I don't understand quite your comments about the future. After all, the preacher is both eschatological.
Well, I would argue that it is not looking forward. I agree with you, it is an eschatological hope. But the eschaton is unthinkable, as you probably perhaps have realized yourself when you try to think about it. The end of history, that's what the eschaton is. But the end of history we are bound to envision as an historical event. And that's a profound logical contradiction. So we can't think about the eschaton. And I would argue, consequently, as I argued earlier, that our task, even though we live eschatologically toward the eschaton, we don't do that by trying to think about it or trying to imagine what it would be like. Rather, we let ourselves be carried toward the eschaton by living in our present situation out of our past. Yes. It's done in a lot of different ways. I mentioned novelists and psychotherapy. And, of course, it's done in ordinary daily life. But perhaps it's done also in Christianity. And Christians are continually remembering the past. And they remember not only Jesus, but they remember, of course, the church fathers. And they remember the development of Christianity. And Christianity can't live without remembering Christian history. Somehow, to me, the most moving examples of memory are in literature. And I think I came to realize what I've tried to say this afternoon through reading Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, which impressed on me deeply the dignity and the imperative quality of remembering, of looking back. But some of it can be just purely personal. I take it that one of the things that one properly does in times of meditation and prayer is to look back just into one's personal life and to face things that perhaps you don't like to face and to meditate on them. Thomas Merton and some monks refer to this as recollection. And as well as I can understand what they mean by this sort of thing, it is collecting yourself together. Because in a sense, you are your past. Going back into the things which have happened to you, what you have felt, and collecting these things together, and arranging them, and trying to see in them the meaning which faith tells us those things are bound to have. I'm not sure I should quit soon, I guess. I'd love to keep talking, but... Yes. I kept wanting to say things about the Holocaust, but that's scheduled for tomorrow evening, and I didn't. But nevertheless, it's a very good question. I can't resist giving you just a very brief answer. To try to say what the Holocaust meant would be offensive. And I don't think we ever take terrible things like that and find meaning of a kind which we can state and say that, well, it led to such and such and consequently it was a good thing. That would be very crude. But let me just give you a hint. And this lies in a wonderful book called An Interrupted Life by a young Jewish woman, Etty Hilsum, who was a victim of the Holocaust. And this book is a journal of her years before she was taken to Auschwitz, where she died. And she recounts she describes her consciousness of the what Nazism meant, and her increasing realization of what it meant, and her experience of the noose being taken in around the Jews, and her friends and relatives being taken off to the camps, and her realization of what was happening to them, and her realization of what was going to happen to her too, and did happen to her. And several times during this experience, she made statements such as this, that life is truly just. Everything that happens is as it ought to be. This is incredible when I say it, but when Etty Hilsum says it, who knew what was going to happen to her, and says it with an unusual power, literary power, it's credible. She gives one an idea that there is meaning in the Holocaust, though she doesn't say what it means. Sorry, I can't say any more than that. Thank you very much.
Just want to reinforce those thanks. Thank you very much, Professor Tinder, for a presentation not only learned and lucid, but I think something that we too rarely hear on the university campus, something that is also optimistic. So thank you. We look forward to hearing the second part of your lecture tomorrow. And I would remind those of you who are interested that there are some books at the front here. Thank you.